A History of Moral Thought, Lecture 8, Being Good and Being Successful. Is it either or?
Like our last lecture, the title of this one is also Being Good and Being Successful. But our philosopher today, Machiavelli, sees a contradiction between the two, while our last philosopher, Aquinas, saw an identity. In the whole history of human thought, no thinker as influential as Machiavelli has ever been so despised. In the whole history of human thought, no thinker as despised as Machiavelli has ever been so influential. Most of his influence is in the field of politics, but he's also the source of much of the modern mind in ethics. All his successors repudiate his teaching. It was much too radical to be popular in its original form, but yet they're all influenced by it. Machiavelli was so unpopular that he was called the son of the devil. And one of the most popular names for the devil was Old Nick, because Niccolo was Machiavelli's first name. So not only was he named after the devil, son of the devil, but the devil was even named after him. Yet, though all his successors reject his teaching, almost all accept some part of it, especially in politics. They just mitigate it and make it more respectable. You probably do too. To see this, take the following multiple choice quiz. Which of the two following statements about politics is true? A. The aim of politics is virtue. B. Politics is the art of the possible. You almost all certainly said B. Yet B is Machiavelli. A is the ancients. Almost all classical political philosophers taught that the aim of politics is virtue. It was Machiavelli who lowered the ideals. I think the world has always felt ambivalent about Machiavelli. Though most of us accept his lowering of the ideals in politics, if not in ethics, yet the word Machiavellian is not a word of praise. The connotations are something sinister, sly, and scheming, immoral or amoral, and purely pragmatic, someone who teaches you to be successful rather than moral, powerful rather than good. And that is not an unfair description of Machiavelli. It's his own description of his intentions in his landmark book, The Prince. Everything he says there follows logically from three master assumptions, one in metaphysics, one in philosophical anthropology, and one in epistemology. They are not ethical or even political assumptions, but everything in Machiavelli's ethics and politics follows from them. I think this is always the case. There are always metaphysical, anthropological, and epistemological assumptions behind everyone's ethics. The metaphysical assumption, the assumption about reality, is that reality does not include ideals or goods or values, that values are not facts, not objectively real. In other words, reality consists only of material facts. Machiavelli is implicitly a materialist. The anthropological assumption is that man is by nature wicked, selfish, competitive, and immoral. This follows from metaphysical materialism, because if only matter is real, then what is real in man is only matter, and matter is essentially competitive. A basic law of all matter is that two bodies cannot occupy the same space at the same time. The more food I eat, the less food there is for you to eat. The more of my money I give to you, the less I have left for myself. Only spirit transcends this law. If spiritual things like love and truth and beauty are real, I can give them away without losing anything. Teachers don't lose knowledge when they share it with others. Lovers don't lose joy or happiness or self-esteem when they give their very self to each other. But material goods like money, power, territory, fame, and glory diminish when shared, while spiritual goods like wisdom, love, and beauty multiply when shared. So if those things are not objectively real, if all that's objectively real in man is matter, then any two men are always fundamentally competitive, like two rocks or two animals. But, Machiavelli reasons, traditional morality says that selfishness is bad, and love and unselfishness and generosity are good. Therefore, morality contradicts reality. Machiavelli's third assumption was that human history could be a science. That's an epistemological assumption about what we can know. That there could be a formula for success in public life because there were only two variables in life. That's why it could be reduced to a formula and to be a science. The two variables were what Machiavelli called virtù and fortuna. Virtù, in Italian, meant not virtue, certainly not moral virtue, but strength, power, prowess, control, the ability to compel objective reality to obey your will, the ability to impose your will on something else. Machiavelli's other category, fortuna, meant not fortune in the sense of a fortune in wealth, but luck, chance, or fate, all the things you could not foresee or control. Machiavelli's formula for success is the maximization of virtù and the minimization of fortuna, or the conquest by virtù of fortuna. Machiavelli's first assumption, the metaphysical one, that ideals are not real, was an assumption about what is reality. The second one, the anthropological one, that man is by nature selfish and competitive and wicked, is an assumption about what's real in man. The third assumption, that human history can be reduced to a science, is an epistemological assumption, a claim that we can know and predict and control human behavior scientifically. But that third assumption is also a metaphysical one, because reducing everything to these two categories of virtù and fortuna, your power and chance, is implicitly the metaphysics of atheism. Now, Machiavelli was in fact an atheist, though he didn't dare say so in any of his public writings. He would have been burned at the stake, or at least exiled. That was the way his society would have reacted. If he had not been an atheist, he would have admitted a third category, God, or the acts of God, the things that flow from divine providence, which are neither virtue nor fortuna, neither what's under human power, nor what happens by mere chance. Now, let's look at how these three assumptions work out in detail in Machiavelli's classic, The Prince. First, it means a radical separation between the real and the ideal. What this means on the most obvious level is simply that our ideals were too high to attain. The classical ideals were like the stars, says Machiavelli, beautiful but impractical, too high and far away to cast light on our low earthly paths. When you are walking along a dangerous mountain road at night, a little lantern a few inches away will give you more light than the stars. That sounds reasonable, almost respectable. If you want to attain your goals, make them realistic, especially in politics. Politics is the art of the possible, we say. We get that idea from Machiavelli. We don't begin with ideal states, ideal societies, as Plato did in the Republic. For almost 2,000 years after Plato, that's what we tried to do, and no one ever attained the ideal state. The gap between the ideal and the real was much too big to bridge. So Machiavelli argues, there are only two possible ways to achieve your ideals. Either bring the real up to the ideal, or lower the ideal to the real. Since the first didn't work, let's do the second. Thus Machiavelli defends the immoralism of the prince. The purpose of this book is not to teach ideals, not to teach morality. It merely asks the factual question, what has in fact succeeded the best in history? And then how can we generalize from these examples what universal principles we can find? Not moral principles, not principles about what ought to be, but principles of success. If you want success, this is what you must do. If you do not want success, but instead you want to contemplate beautiful and unattainable ideals like the stars, why then go ahead and read Plato or Cicero or Aristotle or Augustine or Aquinas or any of the ancient classical philosophers. Machiavelli says, don't blame me for teaching immoralism. Don't judge my book by ethical standards because it's not a book about ethics at all, except in a purely scientific and observational way. It observes what has in historical fact happened to those who have had high and absolute moral principles. And the answer is that they have usually become martyrs. Machiavelli observes, unarmed prophets have failed, armed prophets have succeeded. That is simply a fact, he claims, not a value. A second implication of Machiavelli's assumption about the real and the ideal being so utterly different is that there has to be a double standard. For only a few individuals can be saints, can be very, very good. No society can. Plato had said in the Republic that there was a perfect correspondence between these two, that justice is more profitable than injustice for both individuals and states, and that justice means the same thing for both. Thus, politics is simply social ethics. Well, the fact that that strikes us as strange today is largely due to Machiavelli. For the first time in his thinking, the goal of society is something utterly value-free, something non-ethical, something utterly different from virtue or goodness, something more like wealth or power or control or order or peace or freedom, but certainly not virtue. A third implication of Machiavelli's separation between the real and the ideal is even more radical. Before Machiavelli, it was universally assumed that ideals were the standards for the real, that real events and persons were to be judged by ideals, by how closely they came to the ideal. Machiavelli reverses this. Ideals are to be judged by how realistic they are, how practical they are, whether they have worked in the past. And to know that, you don't need to be a philosopher or a moralist or a saint, just a historian. That can be known by sense experience, by scientific research. Thus, science is the standard for ethics. Empirical facts are the standard for moral ideals. And that sounds very scientific, because in science, every theory must be judged by its data. And Machiavelli treats ethical ideals as theories and history as data. This reversal of the real and the ideal can be seen in Chapter 15 of The Prince. The title is The Things for Which Men, and Especially Princes, Are Praised or Blamed. Machiavelli writes, "This has often been written about before, but I draw up an original set of rules, since my intention is to say something that will prove of practical use. I have thought it proper to represent things as they are in real truth, rather than as they are imagined. Many have dreamed up republics and principalities which have never in truth been known to exist, and the gulf between how one should live and how one does live is so wide that a man who neglects what is actually done for what should be done learns the way to self-destruction rather than self-preservation." Machiavelli is here claiming to expand on Plato, but he's really contracting him. He's claiming to give his readers an education in how people do in fact live, implying that idealists like Plato neglected that. But in the Republic, Plato said that the philosopher king should know both the shadows in the cave, the follies and illusions of popular politics, and the more real world outside the cave, the true ideals, the unchangeable essences like justice. So it's really only a piece of clever propaganda that Machiavelli is opening up a wider perspective, and that the classical thinkers like Plato were more narrow and naive and one-sided. It's the other way around. Also, Plato would agree with what Machiavelli says here, that a man who neglects what is actually done for what should be done learns the way to self-destruction rather than self-preservation. But Plato's goal was not self-preservation. If Socrates' goal had been self-preservation, he would have compromised and lied a little at his trial and saved his body instead of his soul. But Socrates thought a man was his soul, and therefore the values of the soul were the most profitable to him. Machiavelli, in ranking bodily self-preservation above virtue, is assuming that the soul counts less than the body. But unlike Plato, he doesn't say that. He keeps his assumption hidden. Machiavelli concludes, "The fact is that a man who wants to act virtuously in every way necessarily comes to grief among so many who are not virtuous. Therefore, if a prince wants to maintain his rule, he must learn how not to be virtuous." Socrates in the Meno wondered whether virtue could be taught, and Plato in the Republic attempted to teach virtue. Machiavelli claims to teach you vice, how to be non-virtuous. It's usually assumed that Plato had an optimistic notion of human nature, that man was naturally virtuous, while Machiavelli had a pessimistic notion of human nature, that man was naturally vicious. But it's almost the other way around. For if you try to teach men to be virtuous, that assumes that they're not virtuous by nature before you teach them. You teach virtue to sinners, not to saints. But if, like Machiavelli, you try to teach men how to be vicious, that assumes that men are by nature too good. You have to teach vice to saints, not to sinners. What Machiavelli assumes is not that men are good, but that they are too good. too good to survive in the wicked world of politics, which he knew firsthand. Just to take one dramatic instance, the so-called Pizzi Conspiracy was a mutual murder plot between two political factions in Florence, both of whom had allies in the clergy. The culmination of the plot was a botched assassination attempt in the sanctuary of the cathedral during High Mass on Easter Sunday morning at the moment of the consecration. Blood flowed in the sanctuary, and it was not the blood of Christ. One wonders what he must have thought of his followers at that point. Eventually, the congregation captured the two conspirators, one of whom was their bishop, and hung them from ropes out the cathedral window so that the townspeople could see these two dangling 40 feet in the air, each trying to stab the other to death. The crowd's reaction to this edifying sight was to cheer them on, like the crowds at the Roman gladiatorial contests. Well, the young Machiavelli saw this edifying sight. It's not a very great stretch to move from such data as this to the conclusion that man is by nature wicked. But this is not yet ethics. This is the philosophy of human nature, drawn from observation of fact. What conclusion about values does Machiavelli draw from it? One famous and notorious conclusion comes in Chapter 18 of The Prince. The title is How Princes Should Honor Their Word. And the answer to the title question is only when it works. He begins with his usual total contrast between values and facts, between the traditional values everyone admits and what experience shows. He writes, "Everyone realizes how praiseworthy it is for a prince to honor his word and to be straightforward rather than crafty in his dealings. Nevertheless, contemporary experience shows that princes who have achieved great things have been those who have given their word lightly, who have known how to trick men with their cunning, and who in the end have overcome those abiding by honest principles. Therefore, a prudent ruler cannot and should not honor his word when it places him at a disadvantage." Notice how we get a new ethic here, a new should, like Milton's Satan, who says, "Evil, be thou my good." Machiavelli has two arguments for this radical conclusion. One is a supposed fact. He cannot survive otherwise. The argument is that princes should be dishonest because if they are not, they will not survive. The assumption of the argument is that survival is the greatest good. Plato would disagree with both premises of that argument, that the greatest good is survival and that honest men do not survive. Some do. And even those who don't, like Socrates, really do survive if the person is the soul. Machiavelli defines survival and good and man very differently than Plato in the ancients. That's why he comes to such different conclusions. Machiavelli has a second argument for the conclusion that princes should not honor their word. He says, if all men were good, this precept would be good. But because men are wretched creatures who would not keep their word to you, you need not keep your word to them. Let's analyze this argument for a moment, because it's a very contemporary one. It's used by Enron conspirators as well as Pizzi conspirators. Because men would not keep their word to you, you need not keep your word to them. This assumes that your morality is dependent on other people's morality, that how good or evil other people are is your standard. That sounds pretty wimpy to me. Machiavelli has the reputation of being a bold, strong, aggressive, take-charge guy, proactive rather than reactive. I think it's exactly the opposite. He's advising his readers, if they want to be successful rulers or princes, to wimp out and let others set the standard. Like Pontius Pilate instead of Jesus. And why? To survive, to attain success. His argument is from history. This is what works. Well, let's look at history. Which one of those two, Pontius Pilate, the Machiavellian prince, or Jesus, the idealist and moralist and saint, survived? Which one had more virtu, more influence on history, than any other man who ever lived? And which one is reviled and condemned by name a million times a day throughout the world every time Christians say their creed, suffered under Pontius Pilate? Which one attained success? How do you measure success? We don't even have to use any objective standards. Let's just use the subjective personal standards of these two individuals. Jesus and Pilate, which one was happy, satisfied, successful? Which one accomplished his job? But Machiavelli would reply, Jesus was killed. Armed prophets succeed, unarmed prophets fail, he says. Well, to understand why he says this, let's look at another personal experience in Machiavelli's life. In his native city of Florence, which was a very sophisticated and very wicked city, there appeared a simple holy man, a Franciscan friar named Savonarola, a sort of little Saint Francis. He preached repentance and reform, and many people followed him and repented and reformed their lives, and there was a religious revival in the city, and Savonarola was famous and beloved. But a little later, the people itched to go back to their wicked ways, and there was Savonarola, their external conscience, still preaching morality. They tried to compromise him and failed, and they tried to silence him and failed, so they killed him. Machiavelli literally watched as the holy man was burned at the stake, an unarmed prophet who failed. In saying that unarmed prophets fail, Machiavelli is disagreeing with an assumption that almost everyone made before him about human nature. Previous moralists had almost always assumed that there was a strong moral force in human nature, something like conscience or the natural moral law, or what the Chinese call de, spiritual power. Power without external arms. Authority was an old word for that. The Gospels often say Jesus spoke with authority and not as one of the scribes, the scholars. A Buddhist story illustrates De dramatically. A humble little monk who was the wisest man in the land met a warrior who was the strongest man in the land. The warrior was also proud and arrogant. And he said to the monk, I think you are a fake. Show me your wisdom, or I will show you my sword. What can you tell me that I do not know? The monk replied, I can show you the gates of heaven and hell. You do not know them, for you are a fool. The warrior was enraged, got red in the face, and drew out his sword to cut off the monk's head. Pointing to the warrior's face, the monk said, I have now shown you the gates of hell. The warrior thought for a moment, was ashamed, and put back his sword. Seeing this, the monk said, And now I have shown you the gates of heaven. Now that is an example of te. Machiavelli denies that it exists, or at least that it is operative or powerful or part of virtu. He writes, It is unreasonable to expect that an armed man should obey one who is unarmed. He would say that the story of the Buddhist monk and the warrior must have been fiction. It couldn't really happen. It was never really observed. What we do observe proves the opposite conclusion, Machiavelli would say. His argument is this. If man were by nature good, the pangs of conscience would be the pains he fears the most. But in fact, he fears physical pain far more. That's a powerful argument, but it depends on an ambiguity in the word fear. The body fears pain the most, fears suffering evil. But something else in us fears doing evil even more. To see this, make the following thought experiment. Suppose you had a son whom you loved very much and therefore wanted to protect from harm. Your son had been captured by the Nazis and given this choice, either to help Dr. Mengele perform experiments in torturing his friends, his fellow prisoners of war, or to be tortured himself. Which would be more terrible to you? For your son to be a victim of the evil Dr. Mengele, or for him to become an associate, a collaborator of Dr. Mengele? Which is the most horrible nightmare? To be pursued and caught and eaten and killed by a demon, or to become a demon? Don't we instinctively assume that it is even more terrible, more harmful to anyone, to do evil than to suffer it? More unprofitable to take evil into your soul than just into your body, to accept it into your free will rather than to suffer it unfreely, saying no to it in your inner being, even while being forced to say yes to it externally. I don't think you have to be a saint to make that judgment, just a human being. I think we all, deep down, agree with what Plato says in the Republic, that justice is always more profitable to us than injustice, and what he says in the Gorgias, that doing injustice harms us more than suffering it. And even with Jesus, when he says, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his own soul? What good would it do you to gain everything in the world of objects, but to lose the very self or subject who wanted to enjoy all those objects? Machiavelli's denial of te leads him to say something very disturbing about war. He writes, There is no avoiding war. It can only be postponed to the advantage of others. He argues that laws are worthless without sanctions, that is, punishments for disobeying them, and there is no inner sanction, no conscience, no day, so the outer cops, the soldiers, have to multiply because the inner cops aren't there. That's why he spends all his time giving advice about war. He writes, "Because you cannot have good laws without good arms, and where there are good arms, there must be good laws, I shall not discuss laws, but give all my attention to arms." He says, "The art of war is all that is expected of a ruler. It is necessary for the prince to think only about one thing continually, military strategy." Now, that conclusion, which most of us would call absurd, logically follows from Machiavelli's Anthropology. His philosophy of man is that no one is trustable. Therefore, he needs a lot of force instead of trust. And that's just the opposite of being efficient, the opposite of being pragmatic. That's inefficient. It's micromanaging, because you don't trust your staff. For instance, in The Prince, he advises a prince who has conquered a new territory to go and live there himself, otherwise it will be stolen or spoiled by his subordinates. He writes, "We can deduce a general rule, which never or rarely fails to apply, that whoever is responsible for another's becoming powerful ruins himself. In other words, trust nobody. Cooperation is impossible. Only competition is the law of nature. But cooperation is very efficient. If you need laws and police and soldiers, you'll have no time or wealth or power left for anything else." Some comedian, this sounds like George Carlin, estimated that in America, at the present rate of more and more people getting law degrees, in 3 more generations, every American citizen will be a lawyer. So all our money will go to suing each other, and we won't have any money left for anything else, even food, and we'll all starve because there will be more courtrooms than chickens. Let's evaluate Machiavelli's basic assumption that there are only 2 forces in human life, virtù and fortuna, and that success equals virtù's conquests of fortuna, or in a word, control. One notorious logical consequence of this formula was the theme of a thought-provoking movie a decade or two ago about an ambitious kid's initiation into the mafia. The movie was called A Bronx Tale, and the theme, quoted directly from The Prince, is that it is better to be feared than to be loved. This logically follows from Machiavelli's assumption. In Machiavelli's own words, it is far better to be feared than to be loved if you cannot be both. For one can make this generalization about men. They are ungrateful, fickle, liars, and deceivers. They shun danger and are ready for profit. When you treat them well, they are yours, but when they are in danger, they turn against you. They worry less about doing an injury to one who makes himself loved than to one who makes himself feared. For the bond of love is one which men, wretched creatures that they are, break when it is to their advantage to do so. But fear is strengthened by a dread of punishment which is always effective. I conclude that since men love as they please, but fear as the prince pleases, a wise prince should rely on what he controls and not on what he cannot control. That is a perfect example of why I find Machiavelli so useful. He shows us the necessary connection between a philosopher's ethical conclusions and his metaphysical and anthropological assumptions. Those assumptions may seem innocuous until we see their ethical conclusions that follow from them. The formula of relying on virtù and not on fortuna may seem quite reasonable to many people, but the superiority of fear to love seems unreasonable to almost everyone. But the two go together. The premise necessarily entails the conclusion. Nietzsche, a kind of modern Machiavellian philosopher, but much, much more, said, "To understand any philosopher's metaphysics, look at the morality it leads to." I think that's a very perceptive point. Your worldview and your life view, your metaphysics and your morality, your theory and your practice always go together. Here is still another disagreement between Machiavelli and Plato. Throughout this lecture, I've been taking Plato as typical of nearly all pre-Machiavellian thinkers on the most basic issues. For Plato, wisdom consisted in distinguishing appearance and reality, and preferring reality, to know it and to improve it. Machiavelli says exactly the opposite, that appearance is more important than reality for a prince. Or, as the advertisers say, image is everything. Machiavellianism is really the application of advertising principles to politics. His argument is simple. He says, everyone sees what you appear to be. Only a few experience who you really are. Therefore, he concludes that what you appear to be is more important than what you really are. Once again, he is letting others' opinions be his standard. He's wimping out. He's spineless, purely pragmatic, turning his ship into whatever winds fortune blows to him. And a large part of fortune is others' opinion, or appearance, or image. If Machiavelli were living today, he would certainly emphasize control of the media. One of the most Machiavellian men in history was spectacularly successful, at least for a little while, because he was the first to master the modern media as well as the military. His name, of course, was Hitler. Hitler mastered those two parts of virtù, military force and propaganda. There is also a third part that Machiavelli mentions, and that's foresight. Here I think he is truly practical. In any field, for any purpose, moral or immoral, the mind can run circles around the body and cause all kinds of success in the physical order by success in the intellectual order. In war, clever strategy can compensate for inferiority in numbers and weapons. The South almost won the Civil War because of one man's genius, Robert E. Lee. Here's how Machiavelli formulates his principle. He writes, "The Romans did what all wise rulers must, cope not only with present troubles, but also with ones likely to arise in the future, and to forestall them. For when trouble is sensed well in advance, it can easily be remedied. But if you wait for it to show itself, any medicine will be too late, because the disease will have become incurable. As the doctors say of a wasting disease, to start, it is easy to cure, but difficult to diagnose. After a time, unless it has been diagnosed and treated, it becomes easy to diagnose, but difficult to cure. And so it is in politics." I think that's the most practical thing Machiavelli ever wrote. But here he is implicitly contradicting part of his previous advice about military strategy being all that the prince has to master. Here he relies on mind and foresight and practical wisdom. In fact, this piece of advice was given 2,000 years before Machiavelli by Lao Tzu, of all people, in the Tao Te Ching, which is even farther from Machiavelli than Plato is, even more idealistic. According to legend, there was a Chinese emperor who successfully ruled the world's largest nation by the power of something like this principle, but so spiritual that Machiavelli would laugh at the very idea. He ruled China by music. He walked in disguise through the largest cities in his realm once every year, listening to the music the people made, to see whether or not it was good and harmonious and in line with the cosmic music, the cosmic harmonies, and if it was, he left the city alone. If not, he sent soldiers there, because he foresaw that visible troubles would arise soon. And it worked. There's a book called A Muse for the Masses by Donikowski that tries to prove it can work by paralleling musical revolutions and political revolutions in modern times. And it claims to prove that musical revolutions always precede political ones, that music is the prophet of a culture. How utterly impractical that must seem to Machiavelli. The most philosophical chapter of The Prince is the next to last one. The title is How Far Human Affairs Are Governed by Fortune and How Fortune Can Be Opposed. In other words, can the Machiavellian formula be successful? If not, nothing is left, for Machiavelli's whole claim is practical, not moral. It works, not it's good. So if his immoral advice can't even work, that's the most devastating critique. That would prove the moralist's principle that I've called the principle of first and second things. Morality is first, moral success is first, worldly success is second, and if you put second things first, not only will you lose the first things, you'll also lose the second things. Well, here is Machiavelli's bottom line. Here is the way you can be successful by using his formula. He writes, Since fortune is changeable, one who adapts his policy to the times prospers, and one whose policy clashes with the demands of the times does not. Now, since policy comes under virtu, and the times come under fortuna, this means that the only way virtu can conquer fortuna is by conforming to it. Instead of making fortuna conform to virtu, you have to conform virtu to fortuna. It's the old master-slave relationship. The master is really the slave, enslaved to the slave, in need of his slave, while the slave is not enslaved, not in need of the master. In order to master fortune, you have to be fortune's lackey, fortune's wimp. You daren't have a backbone, a character. To be a success, you have to be a conformist to the times, to others' opinions. You have to lose your soul. You have to bend. The conquering prince is really a wimp. Next time, we will look at some of Machiavelli's successors and test his premise that man is by nature basically selfish, competitive, and immoral.
This ends Lecture 8.